So the title of this talk is Innocent Passion. And sometimes these two words we don't usually equate, like passion with innocence, but I think they belong beautifully together. Well, so my first line here was, so we meet again. So when I think of innocent passion, an image, there's two images that came to my mind, and one was a blood orange sun, a blood orange sun rising out of an expanse of sky. So out of a very empty field, something pulsing and vibrant rising. And the other one was of a Waratah flower, which is an Australian flower that grows in different harsh environments. There's this very red, fleshy flower opening again in a very wide place. So I finished the last talk and I asked the question about what qualities rise up inside of us when we feel close to home. These qualities that rise up from the fresh deep and start singing in us when we're closer to our own sense of home. And I would call these qualities the qualities of deep life or the qualities of Buddha nature. Or as the Buddha said himself, qualities that begin to start flashing through. So they're qualities that are evoked in us as we practice. So I reflected on what people said once I'd asked the question. And we had from you, Whitney, you were speaking about being in the water. And so there was the action of being in the water, but what it evokes is something, an internal sense. And so I was thinking it was this fluid holding you were speaking about, a fluid holding. And as I speak these, I think these are all qualities that can start to really nourish our practice. So a fluid holding, a liquid depth, a fluid liquid depth that we can rest into. We had two nature responses. And there was something here of a sense of surprise, seeing something, and an innocence evoked, like a real meeting, a very vital, direct meeting with nature and yourself and yourselves. And yours fitted into this category too. And we also had from you, Keturah, was a sense of this connection with something in nature, something very small and precise, opening up into something even bigger. That's what I heard. And then we had from Florian, the freshness, like that even porridge that we have every day, we could receive with some freshness. And we also had from you, there was a deep laugh, like a laughter that kind of scattered all the other movements away, something that a laugh that gave a good reference point of where we can really rest, a kind of joy. We also heard from you, in one moment you said, and I'm blazing, you said. Something blazes. So there's something in the inner life that blazes, that catches a light. There is this innocence of freshness, and there's something that can blaze with passion. I also had from some other people later, from one person, a sense of warmth, a sense of really resting and having access to a sense of warmth inside. And there was also, from the same person, a sense of strength at the base of the spine, a quality of some kind of unfabricated strength at the base of the spine. So I would say, in this pool of Buddha qualities, there's an intrinsic fire. There's something that blazes and fires. So there's something about these qualities too of relaxing, really relaxing, like in the water. And how then our body can start to move through a wide, loving space, that the space we can inhabit, our body can move through with freedom. That inherent in this water is this a loving allowance of our own play. The water doesn't try to contain us or possess us. It really lets us move and stretch out and swim. There's something about this very generous space inside us that then gives us room to play and come into life. And so that same night, I received a book from Jeff, and it was about dakinis and consorts. So it was about these feminine embodiments of awakening. And all through the book were images of lakes. And I read I found something that spoke about the six pure qualities of water, and water being an inner environment. And so I thought this could be interesting when you swim.
Yeah. Will you please let me look at this?
Okay. yeah. So these six pure qualities of water, and water was often a representation of what started to be evoked in these women's minds as they started to get deeper. So there was relieving coolness. So sometimes in the fire of our karmic movements, we can get a bit pent up, a bit worked up, and something about the deep offers a relieving coolness and a sweetness and a clearness and a freedom from impurities, a lightness and a softness. And the next two are interesting, and it's very soothing to the stomach. So something is, we start to deep and we untie the little worry warts in our solar plexus. Often worry will really grip into the belly. As our worry begins to soften and we trust, there's a soothing quality that can come to the stomach. And the other one was, the water helps us with clearing and freeing the throat. So I'm not sure if that's happening to you when you swim. So these qualities, the qualities, they're not thoughts. We can't think our way into them, but we can feel them, they're to be felt. We can't catch them in a bottle and contain them, but we can open to feeling them. So there really is something about dropping down from the head to the heart and beginning to feel and sense from this heart space rather than this mind space. And as we sink down, these qualities can begin to arise in us and reveal their flavor and their perfume. So I spoke about an Aboriginal man who spoke about this going down from the mind to the heart, and that we have to get a sense of feeling for ourselves. And from that feeling for ourselves, we can get a feeling of, say, the water. We can start to read the land. And from this feeling, we can start to feel each other. I've come back to Keturah again. So Keturah was saying that walking through nature, and we come into something that's very distinct. And if we can stay very present with this one small thing, something very distinct, something very fine, that through staying with that, something even deeper can be revealed. That if we could stay with the detail and the distinctness, that God or whatever you call it, or something unnameable, or something light that's working behind this whole scene, can start to be touched. I remember as a child and looking up at the sky, at the stars coming through the black sky, and I once imagined like peeling off the blackness as if it was a blanket, and just if all the stuff, like everything was just as bright as the stars, like the sky was like an old blanket with little holes in it, which were the light. And I had this sense that there was something that, if I could just stay with it and peel it back, that something would really shine forth, to some sense. So I have a quote from a man called David White, who is a Welshman who loved to walk in the forest. And I think everyone here probably finds nourishment through being in this nature. That in the nature, it helps to evoke something inside of us. So he says, "It is only in the forest I realize how many rooted structures and deep desires exist inside of me. And it is in the forest now, with my breath lifting in billowing spirals in the cold air, that I am suddenly released into small things. A bird's movement on a branch. The sound of water still dripping from yesterday's rainstorm. In the forest, everything in the mind can be given away, so that the heart can be open to the internal concentration that natural objects demand. Through this concentration where nothing exists but what I'm looking at, enormous energy opens out through the woodland's silhouette. By allowing the silence, nothing is held in the mind beyond the time in which it happens. I am deeply innocent before everything I see. The undergrowth rustles without judgment. The marsh can sleep undisturbed by comparison or memory. Out of this energy, an energy that can only be described as praise, arises. And as this intensifies, even this must give way like the distant call in the forest. So that this energy opens up in a void in the center of all things. A passion, a meeting, out of the depth of innocence, comes before me, and there are no expectations here. At this point, the praise suddenly becomes mutual, and I stand revealed. And even this in no way diminishes the luxuriant moss-covered log which creaks, scattering the birds as I sit on it." Very hot in here.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something about nature that we can start to relax when we're in nature. That the defences that can sometimes be there when we engage with each other get a chance to really soften down. And it's often in nature that we can really begin to practice intimacy and trust again, particularly if we've been hurt in some way or another. Like in nature, we allow ourselves to unravel a little more. And this is a really wonderful thing. In nature, we can move away from that sense of self-improvement and just meet what's before us. In nature, often we're available for connection, sometimes in more ways than we are when we're with each other. So in nature, it also gives us time to settle back into our own shape, to not have to be anything for the other, for the other's eyes, but to really relax down. And I remember my father used to, he was quite a social person, but every now and then he would say, you know, sometimes I really wish, Jess, that I'd like to make a little cubby house like up in the sand dunes where we used to go for holidays. And he imagined he would really just live there for quite a while, just undisturbed by everyone. And he'd had it all planned, like he would dig out a hole in the dunes and just have a little peephole that he could look out over to the sea. And the rest of the time he would, you know, just kick back in this sandy abode. And I think sometimes in all of us, possibly, there is that longing to withdraw into a space where we can be very natural, very wild, very however we need to be. There's no pressure to keep up with what's happening. So I thought it was interesting how David spoke about in nature we can be undisturbed by this habit of comparison. And it seems that this habit of comparison really is a hindrance that puts a block on the unique flowering of our own qualities. It's very human, but it really does diminish our own capacity for freedom. And what happens very often when I spoke a little about this before, when we do go into this comparing mind, that there can be, through this comparing mind, an avoidance of intimacy, in a way. An avoidance of intimacy, and also an avoidance or a blocking on learning what we can really learn. And I'll go into this a little more. So, an example. So the other day, with Ajay, we were all speaking about different experiences of samadhi and deepening states that people were beautifully entering and going into. And after this, a number of people I spoke to expressed, "But I'm not having those experiences. Why am I not having those experiences? I would really like to have those experiences." And very quickly, we could be hijacked and we can spiral into the movement of self-doubt. And it really is a hijacking of the being. And it's something I think to really, in life, watch out for. This spiraling into self-doubt, which actually stops us from really being here. So I broke down this movement of comparison and what it evokes inside. So what happens when we begin to compare? So the first thing I thought is that we abandon our own experience. We abandon ourselves. We lose sensitivity to our own dear self, to our own dear experience, whatever it may be. Our own dear self that is longing for a wider embrace. So we forget the fact of this inner jewel that is waiting inside. When we are in the grip of doubt or self-doubt, and it's spurred by a sense of lack, we lose connection with reality. Like, we don't see things clearly. Our vision is marred. In the sense that people in that moment may be speaking of one aspect of their experience, yet in other realms, there's sure to still be suffering and difficulties. So not only do we lose sensitivity to ourselves, but we lose sensitivity to the other that's speaking. And we lose that innocent capacity to learn by what the other may be saying, to allow the other's experience to evoke something deeper inside of ourselves. So I had my own example in yesterday when Jayaji was giving her talk, a beautiful talk. And for a second, I was sort of watching her and feeling her wielding her Dakini-like softness and power. And I was thinking, oh my God, like tomorrow I'm going to have to sit up here. And I was like, oh. And in that moment, I couldn't conceive how I could possibly be sitting up here. And then I realized as I was thinking that, I'd stopped listening to what she was saying. Like, I'd stopped hearing her. I'd stopped receiving her. And so I went, let's not be fooled. And so I just softened. And then I just listened. And I allowed her qualities to evoke something in me. And I just thought, yes. And then I listened and it was moving me and I was relaxing. And so as we move out of this sense of competition that is rooted inside because of how we've been brought up, and we really can be nourished by each other's quality, I think something lovely can happen. When we are comparing to, in that moment, we're objectifying the other. We're objectifying the other and we're not feeling them. We're out of connection. So as we become less guarded, we're not having to defend our own process or our own sense of self, we can begin to receive gifts, more gifts. And I wrote, we can be softly ignited by each other. Like, softly ignited. Pardon?
Ignited.
Ignited, set on fire softly. For we deeply need each other's qualities. Like, we need each other's goodnesses. And we need to learn to evoke that in each other and feel that and drink that and drink that in ourselves. The Buddha spoke about we need to learn how to, if we were in a desert and we were walking through a desert, in order to, the importance of others' good qualities, what he said we should do is to bend down into, say, a footprint that's been left by a cow that's got shit in it and a little bit of water inside the shit, that we should bend down and drink that water. That we should drink that which really serves us and lose the defences and just get what we need. Sometimes in our effort to be independent and self-contained, we can miss out on the juice that's offered from each other. So there's something here about this willingness to reveal what we long for, to really know our need to get drunk on love or to get drunk on that which is going to help us grow. It's like that embarrassment to pray sometimes, like an embarrassment to show our need. But if we can get a little shameless about bearing our deep longing, our deep needs, that there's something in this. And something that can help this to open up, to become a little more transparent, is what Jaya spoke of about this practice of metta. And in a sense, I think in that moment when we're spiraling into a self-doubt or we're in the grip of comparison that gives this our inner being some kind of paralysis, metta is one way to draw us back out of the cold and back into the warmth, because we're literally putting ourselves into the cold when we're spiraling into these movements. So metta can be just actually stay here, just come back and be with me, just come back and be with me. Come back and stay here. Stay. Because metta slowly begins to give moisture to this intrinsic goodness that the Buddha and all the traditions point to. This sense of intrinsic worth. This sense of intrinsic value. It can set loose and set free that sense of this inner jewel, this inner preciousness. And like, this is the place where we can receive compliments, we can receive life, that something can start to open up where we're like, yes, I'm here. It's that intrinsic value that lengthens the front of our bodies, that opens our face to life and to each other, that draws us out of shame and into light. So this is what this metta practice helps activate, something that is intrinsically there. And then from that inner value, we can begin to love a little recklessly. Because we're not protecting our weird, warped kinks, like hiding in shame about them. They're all kind of a bit more transparent. So like, yes, see my awkwardness, see my hatred, see my weird ass closures, whatever, you know. But it's kind of, there isn't that, we don't actually take ourselves out of the room of life, you know. We keep ourselves there with all our kinks and we keep going. We keep going. The Buddha said that love, the practice of love, all the other techniques you can do, don't equal 1/16th of the power of love that softens, that's bright, that flashes forth. And so the Buddha said that. So if Jayaji was here, I was saying in the Buddha Dharma, you have to sort of look far, but I found that one sutta and I was like, wow, it's really beautiful. So love helps us, and we will return to the innocent and passion. I haven't totally lost the track of that. But love helps us really be here. Love helps us really just be here. And if we can listen less with a sense of defense, but perhaps with a sense of openness or a sense of love, it doesn't mean that we would agree with everything that's been spoken at all. But it means we don't have to go into warfare about it. We can just simply, without defense, no, I don't agree. No, that sucks. But it's not like this defense and fight against what's been said. It just comes from something much less defended. And then we can really talk. So, I'm coming back to a sense of innocence, listening from a place of innocence. I have a quote, and I don't know who it's from. A true awareness of beauty cannot be found where I watches it, but where beauty watches beauty. Where receptivity meets others' receptivity. Where the beauty that we see in another evokes not our own sense of inadequacy that then we have to defend ourselves against, but evokes an opening in us. So it comes back to this sense of the generosity of our own gaze. Clearly affects the world in which we live in. How we can gaze without demand. I once was looking at a scientist trying to, in a microscope, understand some wild creature. And the and he was really zoning in. He was like, where are you going? Where are you going? Ooh. And seeing the way this gaze of zoning in and wanting to prove something from this creature's movement was making the creature run madly around the place. Like, maybe you need to look at it differently. It will maybe, offer more of itself, more of its mystery to you. So watching when we're wanting to narrow something into our own mindset, our own sense. And if we can open the gaze and watch with more generosity, like, things start to talk to us in a very different way. So there is something about allowing ourselves the gift of getting out of the way of others' expectations of us, which can set off this whole movement of this comparing mind. I mean, it's totally in our culture. And if we can take off the expectations of others a little more and just meet, like really meet in more freedom, so in the same way that the comparing mind, we can lose a little connection to what's before us. It's that same movement of a desire that moves from a sense of lack into the world. We can also lose some connection with what's before us. When desire loses its innocence, and its sense of play, and its sense of unfolding, and it gets a little serious. When we're seeking gratification, in a sense, like objectifying the other to fit into our own needs, like the scientist with the lens, zoning in, we lose sensitivity and connection with each other. We don't allow the other to have its own true voice, to surprise us and baffle us, sharpen us, whatever it wants to do, And something, this kind of desire, in the same way with comparing, we abandon ourselves. We lose a sense of our own home, our own value. This sort of desire also does the same thing. We abandon the place where we want to be met. We leave ourselves through the movement of desire. So we're not there to enjoy that with which we want. I met a man who told me that he loved to make beautiful meals and he would spend days planning what sumptuous flavors he could eat. And when he would actually eat the meal, he would be so scared it was going to finish, or just so a bit overcome by what he'd created, that he couldn't enjoy it. So if our desires don't actually let us taste that which we want to taste, we're in a bit of a conundrum. I remember when I was in the years that I spoke to you about, from 12 to 17, and sometimes I smoked cigarettes, rollies, and I must have had an internal sense of this, because I would usually smoke two in a row, because I knew the first one, I would be so hungry for that cigarette that I wouldn't be enjoying it. So the first one, I would just be, you know, gashing down, just getting that hit in. And then the second one, I'd be like, now I can relax, you know. Sometimes it's like this, you know, with the good food, we're like, oh, and then it's gone. But I feel like one thing we're doing here in this relaxing and in this settling down, in this dewiring, we're actually opening ourselves to really meet life and feel it and touch it and taste it and let it right in. So the second cigarette, I would just kick back and just, you know, curl it around and play and really enjoy more. So in this movement of desire, very often, as I've said this before, and I'm following this track, seeking to understand more, this movement of desire will project onto the other, especially again if there is some hint of self-lack, project onto the other all the ways they're going to do it or not. And again, we're stopping from our heart feeling the other meeting. We're stopping the meeting. Desire narrows. It narrows our lens. We don't see the whole body before us. The toes, the feet, the hair. All these other avenues for pleasure, yet. Desire, it can just, this kind of desire, narrow in. Or when we're walking and we desire to get somewhere. And so we miss out on the small muscular bodies of birds landing on branches. Or we miss out on the whole light on the water. So it's this kind of desire that reduces experience. It's just something to watch out for. There's something quite different from a sense of stimulation to provoke good feeling, and then meeting and love that provokes profound pleasure. Profound pleasure, which, if not gripped onto, is another ground for insight to emerge. So we're often wired up for that quick fix, arousal, excitement, but as we keep softening down, another avenue of relating can be revealed. So it was in the monasteries that they were really attempting to protect this inner jewel inside. Like, we say no to all these things. We don't believe in the lies that we need this, we need this, we need this to be happy. We're going to deepen in to touch that which is self-sustained, this deep jewel inside, because we so quickly doubt it, that there is this precious jewel. So we so quickly is the habit to fulfill it from outside. But the monasteries were like contained it, so they almost gave you this constraint. So you would have to just stay through these movements, watch their passing, and keep touching something more real. And again, I spoke in the other talk about those reducive practices when desire was there, about women and just looking at one piece of hair and the toenails. And in a sense, that isn't a practice which is feeling. Another way is to really feel the heart of another. That we don't have to reduce them, but we can feel them and then respond to them. And that also is a way to go. So as that monk Tsongkhapa began to rest in deep stillness, that he wasn't moving out of himself through a sense of lack, that he wasn't thinking he was going to become whole by meeting with another. It was from that stillness that then he could really enter into this relationship with this woman, possibly, and play. that in that case we're not moving to have the other fulfill us, then we can move from this sense of innocence. That from a sense of innocence our passion can come. A passion that is motivated by compassion. A passion that arises out of stillness. It's a natural movement of life that comes. And so as we deepen into life and how we can behold that which is before us, of beholding it and treasuring it, that there is something as we deepen our depth enhances each other's depth, that the light in us activates others' light. And so there was a movement into life, a passionate movement that came from a love of life, not this hungry ghost movement. And that takes a lot of metta, a lot of self-containment, a lot of loving. So there can also be a tendency in meditation practice to want to withdraw from life. Somehow, like sometimes in meditation, there can be a sense of withdrawing from life. And as I've said before, for some people there's a mistrust of the way desire has been used, this objectification, this movement for power. But if we can not, because we're not monastics, it's we can reclaim desire and put it in the hands of love, of appreciation. So this innocent passion, if we can allow that feeling inside to land us even more directly with life, as I said before, this movement that brings us into presence, that we can practice where we're not leaving anything behind or withdrawing in our practice, but bringing everything in, that it's a whole body practice, not the waist down, the waist up. It's we use all of us into our awakening. That there's no bit that's kind of left in the dark, but we bring our longings in. This innocent passion that wants us to flower all our colours. As I said before, to taste, to see, to feel the nuances in life, to meet, and because it is this innocent passion that knows the truth of death and the impermanence, that how fleeting each moment is, so gives wholeheartedly to life, that knows death, that knows how fleeting it is, so we'll bring everything in. And that exquisite meeting that we know how precarious it is here, so we can really look and really behold and really be here, allow that for ourselves. So there's something around relaxation and passion, this relaxation and passion, relaxation that allows a very fiery, deep passion for love, for cutting through all these karmic weirdonesses, you know, that cover us, the shame, the withdrawal, the quiverings, whatever it is, but doesn't let us withdraw, that keeps us turning up. And so in a sense, if our practice could be a kind of love affair, that we bring all of ourselves in, that it is a making love to the whole world, allowing ourselves to be that sensitive. So There was, I spoke about my father having that feeling where he wanted to run to the sand dunes and find his little sandy abode, and he'd probably take a few reds with him and red wine. And I remember when I was in the second time I was at Kopan Monastery with Lama Zopa, and I remember my father had just, like, him and my mother had left, and his mother had died, and one of his best friends had died. Like, that impermanence was really hitting home to him, and I could feel he was really suffering, and I could just tell that, like, I remember really feeling it on this retreat and feeling, I bet he just wants to go to those sand dunes, you know? I bet he just wants to go and bunker down and hide away and go in there. And I think he did for a little while. But then something in him, you know, came back into life, and he began working with Aboriginal children in different communities, and he's the happiest I've ever seen him, like, bringing back into life. So, from that metta and from that deep acceptance, there is some passion inside that still wants to ring for life, that can ring for being as full as we can be. So it's like there's acceptance, relaxation, and then there's the passion for life. And there's the, I think it's the dancing Shiva, or it's the one that has this, I accept everything, but I will still ring the bells of love, of depth, of what I can be. So we deeply need this acceptance. Like, we cannot change through self-improvement, through the whip. It just doesn't land, it doesn't sustain us, it doesn't work. We need this ground of metta, we need this ground of self-respect. And then we can slowly, slowly grow our legs and dive in the ways we long to. And sometimes we'll be moved, the passion will move us to do something. And if we can follow that, like, it won't always be perfect either. I think, like Leonard Cohen says, ring the bells that still can ring. So ring the bells that still can ring, even whatever our kinks, I'm calling them, like the movements that move through us that are uncomfortable and awkward. But keep ringing the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. It's how the light gets in. Is everyone surviving in the heat? Yeah. Good. Okay. So I have another question to ask the assembly. And this one is, as we begin to go a little deeper, as we begin to go a little deeper and reveal a little more, I call this, who has a problem with the word God used as deep life? Or can you raise your hand if you have I totally understand, mm-hmm. If you have a problem with the word God. So I'll just use it then. So as we start to deepen, I feel like God, or the deep of us, puts a demand on our process. It puts some demand on us. A beautiful demand. Some way that it wants us to open or soften, whatever. And we think it's suffering, but it's actually love, because there's something that doesn't want to let us get away with not giving ourselves the depth of love that we can. And sometimes we don't do that until we're really shocked, or we're really feeling terrible, or something happens that we remember to really care about life, to really care for ourselves. So sometimes in the face of suffering, life generously demands, makes a demand. And so I just wanted, just seeing how just gently you can feel in to your own heart, And it, and this can be so unique for someone. It may be, this demand may be about, you know, not being so strong, allowing more softening, or it could be just being as I am, continuing, or it could be a more practical thing of diving into something. But there's often some sense that our own process, our own hearts are calling for something. Does the question make sense? Okay. So maybe just seeing how gently, just a moment, just to feel into this. Just some sense of what you feel life is asking for inside of you now. Just resting with that. We can allow ourselves that intimacy and that gift of letting ourselves really feel what it is we long for. And I don't know if anybody wishes to share that, but that's pretty personal, so I'm not really gonna. Okay, Whitney.
Well, I feel like the practice is being very demanding, but yesterday, this is like the piece I'm willing to share anyway. Yesterday in Jaya's talk, when she was speaking about the calling of something, you know, that you want to do, or like even when you're, what you're speaking about, the sort of demand, I sort of immediately knew what that was, this guitar in my closet, if you will. So I went to speak to Jaya about it, and I was like, well, I don't know if I can do this anymore, which is dance, because I used to, like, dance for years and years, and just something terrible happened, and then I just, like, I mean, I really like to dance and stuff, but I don't really like to, like, go to classes or really do it, and so instead of doing that, I've been doing all this other stuff, and then, like, writing, and every now and then I'm like, well, in the future, like, maybe I'll, like, dance or do this, you know, choreography, just, like, as an idea. And so then yesterday I was like, oh, no, like, well, I can't do this. And then I was like, well, maybe I could. And I actually have, like, one of the largest rooms. And I was like, well, I guess I could, but the floor is dirty. And Jaya was like, well, you could clean it if you wanted to. And I was like, and she was like, maybe you could ask Annetta where's, like, a cloth to clean the floor. And I was like, actually, there's a mop on the balcony. So I just, like, went and mopped the floor, and it's just, like, this, like, I mean, it's really terrifying, but it's also really exciting, and so that's what I thought of to share. And there's one other thing when you were talking about the scientist with the microscope, an American scientist, George Washington Carver, said, it's one of my favorite quotes, if you love anything enough, it will talk to you. Not all scientists are so narrow-minded.
No, not at all. I agree. Yeah, nice. Thank you, Whitney. Yeah, and so beautiful demand, that's what I call it. A beautiful demand. Does anybody else have a feeling to speak it out? Or did something come to everybody or not? Or
what is the question?
So as we deepen into the process, sometimes there is some demand or something that, you know, longs for a wider embrace or longs for us to meet it or something. You know, sometimes many women who've sometimes the Buddhist practice try hard and get a little masculinized, then have to surrender a little more and feel this softness and trust that. And that may be what's being asked of in the practice. So for each of us, our process sometimes has something that it's longing for. Don't understand? Or? Mm-hmm. Can you say it, Anetta?
Any demand inside to practice?
Sometimes like our process is longing, say, for more love, or it's longing. I don't know, it's so individual, yeah.
To practice.
Mm. Yeah. So I have a few poems. It's just something to gently feel into. So I have these poems that evoke this innocent passion. And they've come out of a very deep relaxation. So I'll share them. So in the first retreat, I read a poem from a man who said he felt like he had this clenched fist inside his heart. You remember that he couldn't open. And sometime later, he transformed and he started writing like this. He's kind of evoking this. He says, "I want to be bruised by God. I want to be strung up in a strong light and singled out. I want to be stretched like music wrung from a dropped seed. I want to be entered and picked clean." So he changed his tune. And this other one is from Aurobindo, who spent many, many days in silence, very committed to unfolding himself. And so this is really praising this quality. So he says, "Rose of God," it's quite strong language, "Rose of God, damask forsk of infinity, red icon of might, rose of power with thy diamond, halo piercing the night, ablaze with the will of the mortal, design the wonder of thy plan, image of immortality, outbreak of the Godhead in man." So outbreak of the divine in man. "Rose of God, smitten purple with the incarnate divine desire, rose of life, crowded with petals, colors lyre. Transform our bodies like a sweet and magical rhyme, bridge our earthhood and heavenhood, make deathless the children of time. Rose of God, like a blush of rapture on eternity's face. Rose of love, giving depth to all beings, fire, passion of grace. Arise from the heart of the yearning that sobs in nature's abyss. Make earth the home of the blissful and life's beatitude kiss." And then he says, what is the hour of God? What is the hour when a demand comes down to me and will not let me be less than I am? Will not let my heart not love as much as I long to? When God gives me a clasp and says, you are mine. A mystic form that could contain the worlds. A mystic form that could contain all the worlds, but yet makes one human breast its passionate shrine. It draws him or her out of his seeking loneliness into the magnitude of God's embrace. I don't know if there are any questions or anything that needs to be said by anyone. So maybe we'll finish with some silence. So may in this short life that the Tibetans call like a flash of lightning in the autumn sky, may in this short life we taste the fruit that we want to taste. May we see May we hear, may we fully embody ourselves and everything, embody our bodies and everything that is beyond the body. And may we be held. And may we hold in a way that helps us feel deeply at home in the homeless. Have one more prayer, just may we, this assembly here, be blessed by all the Buddhas of the past and the future and the present. Just may we be receptive to that which helps us feel the depth of that intrinsic value and beauty, so that that becomes so solid that when the other moves come in to diminish our capacity to feel our hearts, may this light in the heart keeps strengthening. Thank you for listening.